Jeremy, on top of being a very excellent practitioner and educator in homeopathy, actually I could say he's one of a handful of the top educators we have in the whole community. On top of that, he, more than anything, is really a pioneer for the homeopathic community. He's done a tremendous amount to advance our science and art, especially in the area of provings, where probably his work on the philosophy and methodology of provings, plus all the proving work he's actually done himself with his students, probably has advanced our understanding of homeopathic remedies and our understanding of the science and art of proving itself more than probably anybody in the history of homeopathy. So just that alone makes Jeremy a very important historical figure. When we look back at the history of homeopathy, Jeremy will be definitely written up in the history books as one of the pivotal pioneer figures. So for that, Jeremy, I want to thank you and for all the great work you do and for taking time out of your schedule to join us.
It's my pleasure, Kim. Thank you.
Okay. Also, for those of you who don't know, Jeremy started and directs the Dynamis School, which runs programs throughout the world, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. He also will be the keynote speakers, at the National Center of Homeopathy Conference coming up in April. So for those of you who are not aware, he will be lecturing in Warwick, Rhode Island, and the dates of the event are April 11th through the 15th, and Jeremy will be lecturing for 2 days during that event. So let's get on to the actual subject of the discussion for today. Jeremy, I know you're doing a lot of work now with repertories, and I know you're even developing a new repertory. Could you talk a little bit about the philosophy behind your reasoning for creating a new repertory and a little bit about the actual repertory itself?
Sure, Kim. I'll be happy to. Well, you know, when I teach repertorization at my school, I actually give out a set of guidelines for students and practitioners to follow. And I feel these guidelines are essential for good repertorization. Without good repertorization, of course, it will be difficult to find the right remedy unless we are using other methods, and I always prefer to repertorize my cases, whatever method I use. And the first rule that I give out to homeopaths is the rubric, the right rubric to choose is the rubric with the right remedy in it.
So you know, Jeremy, I've oftentimes used that joke when I've taught classes.
I know it's a joke and it's funny. I laugh at it as well, but it's actually a great rule because oftentimes people, you know, choose a rubric that might seem very fancy or delusion or, you know, a very interesting rubric. But if it doesn't have the right remedy in it, that remedy won't come out in the repertorization.
Sure.
What this means is that I use this as a mantra when I'm choosing rubrics to say to myself, you know, how certain I am that that right remedy will be inside. And we have to bring into account that none of the modern repertories can ever be absolutely perfect, and they never will. And if we make any slight mistake, that reduces the chance of the right remedy coming through. If we choose a rubric that is too small, if we choose a rubric that is not updated enough, or it's only a recently added rubric, these will not always have the right remedy inside. So I kind of hold that in my mind. And when I do that, my second rule for repertorization is, you know, be sure that that rubric is absolutely true to the case. Because so many times people use interpretation. Like, for instance, somebody needs support in their life and they take desire to be carried. Well, it's very impressive and fancy and artful, but it's not exactly what the compilers of the repertory meant when they made that rubric, when they compiled that rubric. So we need to make sure that that rubric is true to the case. If a person has never been well since their mother died, that may mean grief, but it may mean vexation due to the fact that they never got the inheritance or something like that. So this has to be as certain as possible so that the right remedy will be in there. Now, obviously, if we want the right remedy to be in there, we're better off choosing larger rubrics than smaller rubrics. Choosing larger rubrics is a safer way to go, because obviously the percentage, the chance that the remedy is inside it increases all the time, rather than choosing some small rubric with 10 or 15 or 20 remedies inside. In that way, I'm quite advocate of the Bunninghausen approach to repertorization, which says choose large general rubrics. Bunninghausen would take rubrics, or advocate taking a rubric like burning pain, worse at night, desire for sweets, pain in the joints, and then putting these together, and this forms the base of the rubrics, of the remedies that we can choose from, and then we go to the strange, rare, and peculiar, and the keynotes, and the special aspects of the case. So in a way, I see it like baking a cake. You've got the base of the cake, which is sugar, flour, eggs, butter, whatever else you put in a cake. I don't bake that much. And then you've got the icing on top, which is the strange, rare, and peculiar, which says, you know, happy anniversary, Susan. So I say start with the cake, and then you know that that remedy that is covering the totality of symptoms is in the final group you get after repertorization. And then you look at that group of remedies, and you see which one fits the characteristics and the essential nature of the case and the keynotes of the case, etc. I think it's a safer way rather than trying to cut it too fine in the beginning. Mm. Now, that works with big general rubrics, but today when there's an emphasis on the mind, we don't have all the big general rubrics of the mind that we would want. For instance, let's say we have a patient that is very occupied with money. This patient has a fear of poverty, and they want to make a lot of money. They're very stingy with their money. They dream about money. They have many issues relating to money. It's a major feature in their case. Now, we can either choose the best one out of those. Say we think fear of poverty is the most essential aspect. That's one way to go, but it's a bit dangerous. Or we can combine them all together, which is what many people do, and yeah, that's easy to do in radar. You can just control-click, and you put those rubrics into one. But that is a kind of quantitative combining. It's not always accurate. So what I've done is I've created a repertory, a new repertory, which is called the repertory of mental qualities. And in that I have large general rubrics of the mind, qualities of the mind, in other words, characteristics. So if I have a patient who is concerned in that way with money issues, then I just take the rubric money. Now the rubric money will have 200 or 300 remedies in it. But I know for sure that any remedy that has a money issue, big, small, poverty, richness, dreams, extravagance, or any other issue of money, will be inside that rubric. So I am sure as possible that it fits my definition that the right rubric should have the right remedy in it. So if the patient definitely has a money issue, I can safely choose that rubric. And then let's say I have created other rubrics, such as, for instance, snakes. You know, we often have a case where a patient has fear of snakes, dreams of snakes, or delusion of snakes, or any other issue to do with snakes, and we don't know which rubric to take. And I often used to find myself combining them. Now I've created a meta rubric, a quality rubric of snakes, so I can take money rubric and snake rubric. And I know that there's a high likelihood that the remedy will pass through. I've created a lot of interesting rubrics that I think we need in everyday practice. I know I've needed them in everyday practice, and some of them are rubrics that just aren't available in modern repertories. For instance, how many times have you needed low self-esteem as a rubric in a case? And, you know, we see cases with low self-esteem as a major issue every day almost. And it's just not available in the repertory. You can take, you know, disgust of self or reproach of self or lack of confidence, but it's not exactly the right thing, and it doesn't cover the issue. So I've created such a rubric of low self-esteem, of failure as a general issue, of workaholics, of obsessive-compulsive, many issues that we rarely need today and are not easily available. For instance, another great rubric I have is called carers and helpers. All the Mother Teresa types that are going out of their way too much to help other people and wasting their energy too much on caring for others or worrying about others. So, you know, anxiety for others or sympathetic or nursing the sick is just not enough. It doesn't cut it. So now with my repertory, you can start off by doing the generals of the case from a mental point of view as well. So, for instance, in a typical case, I might take such a rubric as, let's say, failure, water, which represents water in general, be it dreams, be it delusions, be it desire to drown or anything like that. I don't have to be too precise in picking the rubric and possibly make a mistake. I'll just take water and low self-esteem and failure or music or any other of these almost 30 rubrics that I've created, and I'll put them together. And you'll be surprised, Kim, because, you know, you're taking three or four rubrics of 200, 250 remedies, and it will boil down in the end of the three or four rubrics to 40 remedies. And out of those 40 remedies, you can now go and use some more particular rubric or look for the remedy with the essential nature of the case. And it helps me so much in my practice. It's a wonderful tool. I'm very happy with it. I think it increases the accuracy, and it makes the whole method more foolproof.
So, Jeremy, basically the way you use this is kind of a first filter to just kind of narrow it down to a smaller grouping, and then you'll kind of use the more characterizing specific symptomology of the case to differentiate from within that grouping. Is that correct?
Well, you can use it as a filter. For instance, you can do your normal repertorization, take three or four characteristic rubrics, and then use those rubrics in Radar. You actually have a facility to use it as a filter.
Right.
So that it will only show if you've chosen, for instance, my rubric control, which is all control issues put together.
Right.
So you can just filter out only the remedies that have control. But when I use it in the way I said before, I don't see it so much as a filter, but as building a base and saying, I need a case that has in it the quality of animals, that is anything to do with animals. I don't care if it's fear or anxiety or love of or sympathetic, and then anything to do with guilt and anything to do with darkness. These are all qualities. These are of rubrics I've created, or knives and points. So I'm taking three rubrics like that: knives and points, guilt, and low self-esteem. And I've created a base. I've made the cake, egg, flour, sugar. And now I can start to see which one of those fit the actual issues of the case. It works really nicely.
And Jeremy, you said you have about approximately 30 of these individual rubrics?
Yeah, I've the first version has come out with 26 rubrics,
mm-hmm.
and we've got another four in the works, so yeah, there should be 30. You know, Kim, this work has taken me the last 4 years a lot of time, because it's not just a simple compilation of related rubrics. We have searched every Materia Medica, every repertory. We've checked every remedy, myself and my team, back to the source to see what it is in the proving, what it is in the case. Is it reliable? Is it not reliable? The reason we've called it the Repertory of Qualities is also because we've tried to make it as high quality as possible, so that, you know, if a remedy is in there, not only has my team checked it, I have personally checked every remedy, both in Materia Medica, provings, repertory, etc.
Amazing. I know it's a Herculean task to put forward a repertory, a project like this. Jeremy, how will this be available to people?
Well, you can buy it from you or from
anyone. Yeah, I know, but is it only going to be electronic, or are you going to print this as a book eventually?
At the moment, it's only electronic. I have received a lot of support from, as you know, Kim, from the Radar people, from Archibald,
right,
in doing this technical and moral, and also supplying people to work on my team. So at the moment, it's available with Radar only, and I think within a couple of years, then maybe we'll print it out or make it available in other forms. But really,
for those of you who are interested, we will be putting up in more information about the new repertory and its relationship to the case taker and other information very soon. So if you want more information, you can just check our website, and we'll have that posted fairly quickly. Great. Well, that sounds pretty amazing. Really, I know it's been an immense amount of work on your part over the last 4 years. I know you've had a huge team of people to help you as well, and I think it's going to make a huge contribution to homeopathy. Are you noticing a real difference in your own practice, Jeremy, with using
Definitely. You know, it makes it easier in terms of, you know, for instance, Kim, if I have a patient who has fear of falling, fear of heights, dreams of falling, and another dream of standing on the edge of a cliff or something like that. I don't have to think which specific rubric will I take, you know. I just take a rubric that I call it high-low rubric. It says everything to do with heights and falling and climbing and anything like that. That's the direction of the case, a major direction of the case. So I'll just take that rubric. It's nice and easy, and it saves me being too fine. And this, it really improves my results because there's a lot of small remedies in there that we've come up with that you just would not get with a normal repertorization.
Great. Sounds great. So, Jeremy, I know you're never only doing one thing at any time. So what other projects are you working on concurrently with the repertory these days?
Well, you know, I've worked on the Case Taker over the last 3 or 4 years as well.
Yeah.
And it's now, you know, the definitive version is now ready. We're very happy with it. I'm working with it all the time, and that does make my practice so much easier, Kim. You know, because when I do patients, especially over the phone, I have phone clinics from New York and from London, and I'm seeing a lot of patients quite quickly. It makes it much easier for me to access a case quickly. You know, I don't have to use filing cabinets and lose cases and try to read my handwriting. And there are many features in the Case Taker that make my life easier, you know, underlining and automatic indexing of symptoms, and I can easily see a follow-up, you know, compare follow-ups to the original case. So it streamlines my practice, it's more organized, it's more efficient, and in that way it also helps my results. So I'm really very happy with it, and those
Great.
Who are working with it are giving very good feedback. It's been a lot of work, you know. I'm not a programmer or software person, but in both the repertory and the Case Taker, I've taken bits of the philosophy that I teach in the Dynamis School, which I believe are, you know, classical homeopathic philosophy, and I've transferred them into a tool that can actually be used practically.
Mm. That's great.
So those are two of the projects that I've done, and, you know, they're just about ready now, so I'm very happy with that because it's been a lot of work, you know. And another project that I'm spending a lot of time on is my work with AIDS in Africa.
Oh, yeah, can you tell us about that? That's very interesting.
Yeah, you know, this has been a dream of mine for many years. I just believe it's a mission that has to be done. And I've worked on it really over the last 10 years trying to get it together. And you would think, you know, why is it taking so long to do? And I do too, you know. And that's because I wanted to set up a proper project, a project that, you know, we could show to the world what homeopathy is doing with AIDS. I think I heard just at the beginning of the conversation one of the listeners talking about, you know, the recent attacks on homeopathy. And I think, you know, we have to show what homeopathy can do. And the real battleground in medicine today, one of the main battlegrounds, is AIDS. But more importantly than that, you know, they're predicting that by 2010, 24 million people will have died of AIDS in Africa.
Mm.
And that's a horrendous number, you know. AIDS is devastating Africa totally.
Sure.
And I know, you know, from my work with AIDS in America, in England, and in Tanzania, that homeopathy can be very, very useful for AIDS, you know, and we've actually seen fantastic results.
Mm. Can you tell us specifically, like, how are you organizing this project? What do you do? Are you going to different cities in Tanzania, or what are you
doing? No, we're setting up. I have a partner in Tanzania, a homeopath who has a very busy clinic there. He's treating a lot of AIDS and a lot of malaria. And he's been working over the last few years to open a school in Tanzania. And that's nearly ready. It's not easy because there's a lot of bureaucracy and issues there with everything you do. It's one of the reasons this has all taken so long. And I have partnered with him. You know, I've raised a lot of money for his school. And now what we want to do is set up a clinic that is only for AIDS. And I'm planning to go out there next year and be there as much as I can. And once we have the clinic running, my real aim homeopathically, Kim, is to look for Genus Epidemicus for AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's what has to be done because, you know, when you're treating
Jeremy,
that many
people... Who maybe are not familiar with that terminology, could you just explain what that means?
Yeah, sure. You know, homeopathy has a long history of treating epidemics over the last 200 years. And Hahnemann lays down a very fine and precise philosophy regarding the treatment of epidemics, which basically says that epidemics should be seen as if it was one person, never mind if it's 500 or 5 million people suffering from the same epidemic. You're treating one organism. And therefore, rather than doing each case as a single individual case separate and new from all the others, you have to look at it and find the remedies that fit that organism as a whole, that epidemic as a whole. So I think most people who study homeopathy know the famous story of Hahnemann's treatment of the cholera epidemic in 1812, where he used veratrum and camphor and cuprum, and that was a Genux epidemicus for that epidemic. Now, the huge advantage of this is it makes it much easier to teach a lot of people how to treat the epidemic very, very quickly. Because as you can imagine, if you know, you're going to take a 1 or 2 hour case for each patient suffering from AIDS, you're not going to get very far if we have to deal with a serious number of people sick from it. So we want to find a group of remedies, a small group of remedies, maybe it's 10, maybe 20, maybe 30, that fit this epidemic. And once we do, it's, you know, the idea, the aim is that you can teach local health providers how to use homeopathy for AIDS in a much easier and more concise way so they can go ahead and make a real difference. To do this, I believe I have to see 500 to 1,000 cases, and that's really what I want to do. So at one time, I want to find the remedies for the epidemic. I want to show the world what homeopathy can do in this, and I want to help to raise awareness and teaching of AIDS in Africa.
Interesting. Jeremy, are you beginning to identify remedies that seem to fit the AIDS syndrome?
Well, one thing, Kim, I've been very, very careful not to be prejudiced because I believe that it's really important to go to this, whole issue free from prejudice. So
sure.
A lot of people come to me and say, I've had an AIDS case of this or that or the other. And I say, well, you know, that's interesting, but I try not to be influenced because I actually want to see a lot of cases before I say that this is a good remedy for AIDS. But I'll tell you, rather than getting into a specific remedy name, which I think is premature, what has been interesting for me is that a lot of homeopaths associate AIDS with syphilis. And there's some merit in that. You know, it's actually a historical issue. I'm sure you're familiar, Kim, with Harris Cooper's
sure.
books, AIDS and
sure.
Syphilis, which came out very early in the AIDS epidemic, I think, you know, in the late 80s or early 90s. And, you know, Harris very cleverly compares AIDS and syphilis, but therefore homeopaths tend to think automatically, oh, AIDS is a syphilitic disease, and there is some of that. But in my preliminary research of, you know, putting together a lot of AIDS symptoms, studying it theoretically, and then treating approximately 30 to 40 cases of AIDS in Tanzania, to my mind, in this early stage, I think AIDS is more closely related to tuberculosis. The biggest killer of AIDS patients is TB, really, in Africa.
Right.
Because, no, you know, people don't usually die from AIDS per se.
Right.
They die from opportunistic infection. And tuberculosis is very closely affiliated. And a lot of the symptoms, such as swollen glands and, afternoon fevers and lung cancers and skin problems and low immunity relate to tuberculosis. Now, there is some relationship in homeopathy, as you know, between tuberculosis
sure.
and syphilis, but they're not exactly the same thing.
Right.
And that's been very interesting to me. And that's an example of what prejudice can do, because a lot of people are going out and saying automatically, I'll give sulfalinum or something like that. And that's the kind of thing I want to be careful of.
Very, very exciting. Jeremy, how much longer do you see this project going on for? I mean, how many more years are you going to...
Well, if you want me to give you my ideal dream answer, I'd say until AIDS in Africa is cured, Kim.
Yeah.
But, you know, the stage that I'm in now, once I've passed a lot of the bureaucratic hurdles and all kinds of obstacles we had in the way, I'm starting to raise funds this year because, you know, we need funds to set up the center, to get translators, to get administrators, to get the equipment, to advertise it in Africa, you know, to allow me to, I've given up all my work for next year to allow me to go out there. So I need something to live off. So, you know, all of that, you know, we're trying to raise money to actually make that happen now. And if any of you people out there know somebody rich who wants to donate, that's really welcome.
Jeremy, wonderful project, wonderful gift to humanity. I thank you personally for it. It's really, really great service you're doing.
Thank you.
So, Jeremy, you know, I know people probably are well aware of the fact that you've been one of the most instrumental individuals in advancing our understanding and development of materia medica through provings. Are you still doing proving work right now? Are there any remedies you're proving or anything?
Yeah, I'm proving remedies all the time, Kim, because, you know, I run my postgraduate course, the Dynamis School, and part of that course, an essential part of that course is doing a proving. You know, I really think that a homeopath who hasn't done a proving is not yet fully a homeopath because you learn things on a level that are not intellectual. It's amazing how I can, you know, explain so many of the issues in class many, many times. And I know that as soon as a class finally does the proving, they'll say, wow, you know, we heard you say it so many times. We just didn't get it till then. And once they've done the proving, they get it. So, you know, I'm doing a proving every year, more or less, and the recent ones that I've done so many now, it's, you know, that it's, I did, 2 years ago, I did pomegranate, and that was, you know, a really exciting proving, and, you know, there's a lot of herbal knowledge together with it as well, and we have the remedy called granatum in homeopathy, but with
right.
a poor proving, and this is a very good remedy, especially for female issues, menopausal, hormonal. Very, very excellent remedy. Of
wonderful.
Course, it's got... Sorry, Kim?
I said great. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it is. It's a great remedy. Of course, each of these have their specific pictures. The previous year in Minnesota, I did an interesting experiment. I think you'll like this, Kim. I didn't... some people have put forward the idea that because I know what the remedy is, I, you know, can... subconsciously or psychically influence a class in the remedy, in the results of the proving. So I decided, and, you know, I usually do choose and know the remedy because I just find I prefer it because I put a lot of intention into choosing the right remedy for that particular group of
right.
people I'm working with.
Somebody's got to know the remedy.
Well, yes, but you can have it like triple blind, in which
case... You could
case,
have a triple blind, but somebody's, the supervisor's going to, the guy who sets up the experiment's going to have to know.
Well, we did it in a different way. I told somebody else to choose three remedies, one from the animal kingdom, one from the mineral kingdom, and one from the vegetable kingdom.
I see.
And then I had the pharmacist prepare all three, and then the pharmacist chose one randomly out of that group. So nobody actually knew.
I see, interesting.
You see, and another purpose of my experiment was to say, okay, a lot of people talk about kingdoms these days. Well, you know, let's see how that works out in terms of approving. So we did the proving, and by the end of the day, you know, when everybody sits and listens to the reports of the provings, it's, you know, a very long and exciting day, and you get a kind of preliminary picture of the remedy. I said what I always say to the class. I always say, well, what remedy do you think it is? And usually people don't guess the remedy. anyway, I said to them, who thinks it's an animal, who thinks it's a mineral, and who thinks it's a vegetable? Now, 70% of the class voted for mineral, and 30% of the class voted for animal. Nobody voted for plant.
Mm.
And, of course, it was a plant remedy. And, you know...
What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on that, look, I do not... I'm not a big subscriber to the whole kingdom method. I think it's quite a superficial method. I think homeopathy is very cross-platform. It brings out the real inner nature of a substance. A plant can look like a mineral can look like an animal can look like a mineral. It's all very mixed in this very high world of simple substance and potency. You know, it's not so easily defined. I find that is a problematic way of choosing remedies, and I see people making a lot of mistakes. And this confirmed it for me because, you know, if nobody chooses a plant remedy after they've heard Pruvas speaking all day about their experience and it turns out to be a plant remedy, well, you know, it's not a big point towards this, the whole kingdom method.
Very interesting, Jeremy.
Yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of little experiments you can do while you're doing provings to find out things. The remedy turned out to be wild rice.
Mm.
I was doing that proving in Minnesota, and that's the state plant of Minnesota. And I can tell you that that remedy physically was one of the scariest provings I've ever done.
Really?
Because it nearly sent three people to hospital, including myself. Yeah.
Oh.
With heart issues. You know, I ended up in the intensive care thinking I've got a heart attack.
Wow.
I never go to hospital for anything.
Wow. Well, that sounds like it might be a very useful remedy then in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, think, you know, so many of the plant remedies are heart remedies like aconite, digitalis, etc. And I could not understand where it came from, but it was a vicious remedy in that regard, you know.
Wow.
So that was very interesting. Zizania palustris, it's called, wild rice. And then the very last proving I've done.
It hasn't been published yet, right?
Sorry? No, that's not published. And I'll say something about publication in a couple of minutes. So I'll just tell you about my latest proving. In my latest proving, which we're just in the process of finishing the first stage of, I've done that in Dynamis Manchester, is actually a fungus. And I've had a lot of interest in fungus over the last few years, and that's come from all kinds of areas. And one of the main ones was working with AIDS, because I have hardly seen an AIDS patient that doesn't have a fungal problem. You know, that's one of the first things that shows up, and it's one of the last things that shows up on the skin, in the tongue, in all kinds of candida-related symptoms, etc. And if you know something about funguses and the way that they kind of spread, they are giant organisms. You live, you know, in an area where there's a lot of huge fungal organisms spreading out over hundreds of acres. I'm sure you know about that, Kim.
Sure, the mycelia, sure.
Yeah. And in that way, it's I see it as quite related to epidemic because you're talking giant organisms over here. And funguses are very interesting in the way that they, you know, latch on to living organism and actually, you know, in a way, they can be symbiotic with them, but they can be very destructive of them or eat up the results of destruction. And a lot of people are now linking funguses with cancer and with other serious diseases. And, you know, I've seen a link between, in my practice, between candida and between anorexia. In some specific cases where, you know, I started to realize that anorexia, rather than being a mental and emotional problem, is actually often related to fungal organisms eating up all the nutrition, and the person is actually trying to starve the fungus. So a lot of thoughts on that nature. So I decided to prove a fungus, which... And then, with the help of Franz Vermeulen, I chose a fungus that is most related to AIDS, and that is called Cryptococcus.
Mm.
And that is a fungus that is actually found in pigeon stools.
Mm.
And it's and in AIDS patients, it's one of the defining qualities of AIDS or symptoms of AIDS to have. So if you see a patient and he has a cryptococcus infection, that is another symptom of to say that, yes, you have AIDS. And it was a very interesting proving, and I think it does relate to AIDS on some of the higher issues of this remedy.
Very interesting. Jeremy, since we're talking about provings, I'm going to just ask you this question, and if you, you know, you can just ask, you can answer it to whatever degree you want. I know it's a fairly lengthy discussion, but Paul Hirschke wrote a couple of books on provings, and in the second book that he wrote, he made some criticisms of some of the methodology written about in your book, and I was curious if you'd like to comment about that, or if you have any discussion, intellectual discussion about the difference of opinion relative to provings, or anything about that?
Sure, I'm happy to. In fact, Kim, you know, that's true what you say. Paul, in his book, dedicated quite a lot of his book to criticizing my methodology. I'm not too sure why. And last year, Neil Tesla from Similimum interviewed me about the same question, and it actually turned out to be a 35-page article that, in response to these issues, which I think I said most that has to be said, and that was published in Similimum last year, and also in the HPATHY e-zine that came out, I think, in November or something like that, and it's on my website. So if you want to go into the specifics, you can read it online. But I'm I didn't agree too much with Paul's criticisms, and there were many of them. And the one thing I said, you know, is that Paul had approached me with his ideas, and that was long before he'd done any provings. And when he published his book, he'd only done one proving. And by that time, I'd done about 30. So I think, you know, it's important to have a lot of clinical experience before you jump into the theory of it. But let me just give you one example of something that I disagree with him. You know, Paul was making a big point that I don't have a definition of provings. And, you know, I don't think her definition is that paramount. You know, it's not going to make the difference between a good proving or a bad proving. And I do have a definition, which appears in the book in various guises, but I don't go out and say, this is my definition of provings. But what is interesting is that Paul's definition is that a proving is a follow-up, the same as a clinical follow-up. And what I said in my answer is that, you know, this is a very limited point of view and not accurate, because there's a vague similarity between a follow-up and a proving in that you're looking at remedy reaction, yes. You know, so you give a remedy in a proving and you give it to in the clinical setting and you're looking to see what happens. So in that way, it's a similarity, but that's where the similarity begins and ends. So let me point out where it's this kind of thing is inaccurate. When you do a clinical follow-up, you do it on sick people, and a proving is done on relatively healthy people. So in a clinical follow-up, you want to make sick people healthy, and in a proving, you want to make healthy people sick. And that makes for a fundamental difference. Another thing is that in the clinic, you're trying your best to give a similimum, whereas in a proving, you're giving a random remedy, and in a way, you're hoping that it won't be a similimum. It's the opposite, because you want to see proving symptoms. And if you give a similimum by chance in approving, you're going to get a cure but not approving,
right?
Which is not as good. It's nice, but it's not as good. And another fundamental thing...
Can I just
talk
to you about that? I'm just curious about why you
please.
Think that. Because I would think that if a patient came in and the proving substance was their similimum and you happened to give it to them and their symptoms went away, that those symptoms would be the same as clinically verified symptoms in practice.
In approving. If you
wouldn't that information be just as useful as information?
In theory, it is. But let me tell you what happens in practice.
Okay.
People come and say, you know, I feel so much better. Everything is going in my life. I feel happy and all this kind of stuff. But what you're not getting is, you know, exactly what was it that was cured here? Now, you have to be a really good supervisor to elicit that. You have to have taken a really good case before, which all my supervisors do, but you have to know exactly what was cured in the case. And that is not always so straightforward as a negative.
Mm.
If a person comes and says, you know, I took this proving and for the first time I got a burning pain in my knee. You know, that is a definite thing. Whereas here you're saying something that has vanished, taken away. So both are useful and it's good to have both. But really the idea of a proving is first of all from the negative, from making a person sick.
Right. Okay, good.
Other differences are, you know, in approving, you have a daily supervision, whereas, you know, clinical follow-up, you know, you see a patient after 6 weeks or 4 weeks. This is a major difference because when you do daily supervision, you see things that you would never, people would not be aware of or remember after 6 weeks, you know. It's very, very fine. And another thing is that in approving, you know, you're prescribing the same remedy to a lot of the people in the same time. So this is like an epidemic. Approving is actually a, you know, artificial epidemic.
Right.
Now, there's a huge difference because approving is much more powerful than an individual follow-up in clinic. And the reason for that is, one is because of the power of the epidemic. You see, the remedy is just an infection. You're infecting a person with something. And this infection spreads even if the person had placebo, even if they just, you know, standing by, nearby. The energy changes.
Mm.
And just as if you were infected by a virus, you're going to be infected with this, you know, with this proving. And it's much more powerful when it's amplified by many people and by the intention of the provers to prove, and by the super awareness of each prover of themselves and through the supervisor. So you're getting, you know, a totally different game here than just the clinical follow-up, really, if you put all that together. So if you were going to follow Hirschke's definition of approving as a clinical follow-up, it would only almost be correct if you, the clinician was a very poor prescriber, not giving a good remedy, using a fairly healthy patient, giving a lot of patients the same remedy at the same time, and following up daily with the intention of recording all the aggravations and editing them as if they were one person. So, you know, it's like, yeah, this is like seeing a very narrow window of the whole thing and not the whole picture. And this whole picture you need to get from doing quite a few provings and seeing the process.
Mm. So I know this is a lengthy discussion, and what I'd like to suggest for people who are on the call or who are listening to the recorded session is to simply go to Jeremy's website. Can you tell us the URL, Jeremy? Where would
yes, it's Dynamis.
Yeah.
Everybody knows how to spell Dynamis.
D-Y-N-A-M-I-S.
.edu, short for education.
Okay, and then when they get there, how would they find specifically that article?
There's articles on there, and you'd find the articles there, and, you know, most of my interviews are published online.
Okay, yeah, I think that's probably a good thing for me. And, you know, for me personally, Jeremy, you know, these types of discussions where people are discussing different points of view, I think are very useful for our profession because I think it allows us to gain deeper insights and understanding. So I really appreciate the fact that you and Paul have had this discussion on the nature of proving. So.
Sure, we learn from controversy.
Absolutely, yeah. So listen, Jeremy, I know you were at the Heidelberg conference in Europe that was sponsored by Homeopathic Links, and that was quite a major conference in Europe. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, this was a one-off event that was very exciting, Kim, and you know, I was proud to be part of it because this was 20 years to Links, which is, you know, a major publication in homeopathy. And in some ways, you know, it was like 20 or 25 years to the new homeopathy, to the resurrection of homeopathy. And it was great to have a lot of the well-known international teachers there all together. You know, Rajan and Massimo and Scholten and Anashade and Nandita and sorry if I'm forgetting anything, but a lot of other, Alisa Timmerman, you know, a lot of interesting teachers. And, you know, now, as everybody knows, different teachers have difference of opinion and, you know, different approaches, just as we saw now, Hersky or myself, or, you know, George and Razan or whatever. But what was nice to see there is there was really a spirit of love and unity between the participants and the teachers especially. And, you know, these are all people that we meet on the teaching circuit over years, and it was just really nice to get together and have a beer in the evening and have a chat of homeopathy and, you know, see that although we're taking different paths, we all striving for the same thing and, you know, we come from the same place. And that was a really nice and well-felt spirit over there.
That's wonderful. How many people were there, Jeremy?
I think there must have been 1,000 people there.
Oh, that's a huge turnout.
Yeah. It's big. It was a nice turnout, and I had the privilege of giving the wind-up talk there of the conference, and I spoke about things rather than speaking about, you know, a lot of topics that teachers will speak about, which is how to find the remedy. I spoke about, you know, where I think homeopathy is going and what homeopathy needs as a whole these days.
And Jeremy, mostly Europeans were attending the conference, or was it people from all over the world? Or
I would say people from all over the world, but
yeah.
You know, it was in Germany, so mostly Europeans, yes.
Yeah, and they're going to do it again next year?
I don't think so. I think this was a one-off, you know, of 20 years, and I don't think there'll be such a big one for the next 4 or 5 years. So if you see another big one like that, you know, try and make it.
Yeah, okay. So, Jeremy, I see we're running close. I'd like to give people an opportunity to ask you some questions directly, but before I pass it over, are you doing any other work, any writing?
Mm-hmm.
I know you've been doing some stuff with remedy kits. Anything else you want to share with us?
Yeah, please. You know, I mentioned before about the publication of the provings.
Yeah.
And to be honest, this is, you know, something I feel a bit bad about, but I'm although I've published 13 or 14 of my proving remedies, I'm lagging behind in publishing the provings, the later provings. And the proving that is unpublished, people can't use. So I beg the forgiveness of the community for that. But you know, Kim, that I have devised another piece of software that I feel will make reading and studying and editing proving so much easier. And I'm just waiting for the powers that be to go ahead and help me develop this software so that I can publish a lot of these provings. So I hope that will happen soon. And the other thing I'm writing about, you know, when I get any spare time, is I'm writing about the noble gases. And as you know, I've proved all the noble gases together with my proving partner, that's Sylvie in England, and I see them as special interest for understanding the periodic table. But I've decided to write not only the proving, but my thoughts about it this time, and I've actually finished writing helium, which I'll be talking about at the NCH conference, and I hope, you know, I get the spare time to get on with the rest of that. So that's what I'm doing in terms of writing. And you mentioned the remedy kits. Yeah, you know, I have another one of those silly little rules of mine, which says that a homeopath without remedies is not a homeopath. And, you know, I'm sure you remember, you know, you find yourself on the airplane with some screaming kid or something like that that you really want to help, or, you know, out in nature somewhere where you can't get a remedy and you need a remedy and it's just you don't have it. Well,
you know,
Jeremy,
sorry, but the one that makes me laugh is that anytime you go to a homeopathic conference and anybody feels sick and you ask for a remedy, nobody has a remedy. Did you ever notice that?
Exactly. Absolutely, which is totally shameful.
Unbelievable.
And, you know, I always have a kit with me, but that's, you know, a 36 remedy kit, and that's okay for first aid and for amateurs, but a serious homeopath needs to have at least 200 remedies on them.
Sure.
Even that is not enough. Now, there are kits available, but they're just too big. You know, you can't carry them around. I think they're fundamental mistakes in design, and nobody wants to be carrying a suitcase around with them. So I've devised a kit which is very small and compact that can fit into your handbag or your computer bag, and it has 200 remedies in it.
Oh.
And it's, you know, it's a professional kit, and we're in production of it now. We've made the bags, and we're getting the remedies together. So I hope that'll be ready in a month or two, really. And
if people want more information on that, where could they find it?
They can, you know, once it's ready, it'll be on my website. You can
okay.
register your name as interested in my website, and maybe even you'll be selling them, Kim.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Jeremy, thank you. This has been a very informative call and a lot of very wonderful, useful information. Also, I want to just acknowledge all the wonderful work you're doing for homeopathy. It's pretty amazing that you could find the time and the day to involve yourself in so many different projects. So
I tell you, Kim, it's more difficult when you have six kids like I do.
I hear you. Well, let me pass it on to the audience and see if anybody has some questions for you. Thank you, Jay.
Sure.
Hold on.
Do it.
All right, everybody there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yep,
does
we're
anybody
here.
Have a question for Jeremy Scherer?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes? Somebody have a question they would like to ask Jeremy Scherer?
Yeah, I'll jump in because I do have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, could you just say who you are and from where?
Absolutely. This is Lois Bergman. I'm from Minnesota. Just graduated from class 5 at NAH.
Hey,
Northwestern Academy. Hi, Jeremy. It's good to see you at Eric's funeral at his memorial service. Anyhow, I have a question. I've been seeing a few young people who are very gothic, I think is the word they use, and this is a repertory question.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's too simple a question, but golly, I want to ask somebody. kids who are interested in vampires and just very, very focused on the dark, on the macabre. I wondered if you could say anything about that and repertorization.
Right. This is a difficult one to repertorize. You know, you would think that maybe in my repertory of qualities, I should have a rubric saying goth.
Yeah.
but, you know, these are the things that you can't actually grasp in rubric form because you're talking about the fashion, you're talking about the trend.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know there's a common denominator of people who are being attracted to this trend. But then it's very fine to separate what are the fashion items here, for instance, the clothing that is worn or the metal rings or whatever it is, and what is it that is behind there in the person that will attract them to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very cultural, and it's difficult or impossible to repertorize culture. Now, I'll give you an example, Kim. He's working in Japan a lot, aren't you, Kim?
Yep.
And so you'll be very familiar with the whole manga, is it called?
What, I'm sorry?
The comics in Japan.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What are they called? Magna?
Yeah, I
got or manga?
Yeah, I know.
Okay, you've got to know this. It's bigger than goth, you know. And it's, okay, it's people who live their life through comics and superheroes and stuff like that, the Japanese comics. And it's difficult to repertorize that as an item. So what I think you have to do, Lewis, here is, you know, you have to go behind, unfortunately. I know I'm not giving you the easy answer, but you have to go behind and say, what is it in that person that is leading them to that kind of expression? You know, because let's look at it, I mean, if... you're probably a lot younger than you me, but if you are anywhere near my age, and maybe you were a hippie in the 60s.
And, I actually am very close to your age.
Okay. And you know what they say about the 60s. If you can remember it, you probably weren't there.
Well, unfortunately, I was there, and I do remember
you
it.
You do remember it, huh? So, you see, it would be the same thing as saying to repertorize hippie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we look the same. We had long hair and baggy jeans and whatever else it was, but behind it, each one had their personal issues, which were very different one from the other. So I'm afraid there's no easy goth rubric over here, really.
Oh,
but
okay.
You might, if you saw a lot of these people, you could approach it like an epidemic. And then you'd say, you know, in all these goth people, I've seen the strange symptom of dreams of vampires.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be a non-cultural thing so much. It would have to be something that was, you know, that was behind the fashion of it. But you know, one when you mention vampires and bats and stuff like that, then the one remedy that comes to mind the most is, of course, plutonium, because that's a remedy that comes from the underground, from the underworld, you know, from the dark side, and and has a lot of bats and vampires in it. But I wouldn't hazard to say that's a remedy for all goths, but you might eventually find some group of remedies. But culture is not epidemic, you know, so much. It's infectious in a way, so it is like epidemic in that it's infectious, but it has other characteristics that make it non-epidemic. It's not a fever, for instance.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry that I can't be more specific in terms of remedies.
But no, actually, you helped me with the question, because I was thinking of a metal way over on the right and kind of down on the bottom, as far as the table of elements was concerned, but I hadn't really settled on one.
The down on the bottom, don't think only of the way over on the right, but the down on the bottom, meaning the seventh period, the radioactive period,
right.
All has to do with, you know, issues from deep under the ground, from the collective subconscious, from, you know, also the bottom chakra to do with the home chakra, you know, perineal chakra. And of course, it's heavier than a heavy metal, you know.
Right.
You see a lot of mercury case. You think a case looks like mercury, but it's just not heavy enough for it, and it'll turn out to be a radioactive.
Okay. Cool.
I think we have time for one more question. So does somebody have one final question they'd like to ask to Jeremy Scherer?
This is Sydney from Texas.
Hi, Sydney.
Hey, Sydney. Hi.
Hi. I was very interested in what you were saying about AIDS and tuberculosis and malaria. And the reason I felt so interested in it was I've been seeing a number of autistic spectrum kids that have responded very well to tuberculinum, and a couple of them have had tuberculosis in the history. And I just it just made me very curious. Are you seeing both tuberculosis and malaria, or just tuberculosis in the AIDS?
More tuberculosis, but look, malaria is still the biggest killer in Africa. Out of all the killers in all history, malaria is the biggest killer that ever was, and it still is the case today. Now, malaria isn't directly related to AIDS, I think, but it'll kill off a lot of AIDS patients. Because once you've got AIDS, you know, and I see people walking around there with a CD4 of 20, which is extremely, extremely low. You know, normal people have 1,500. And all it takes is a common cold or a slight malaria infection, which everybody gets there, and that will knock you off. Any little thing can knock you off. But otherwise, malaria behaves, you know, quite differently from AIDS, I would say, in a way. You know, it's interesting, if you know a bit of Chinese medicine, in Chinese medicine, the lungs are connected to the immune system, meaning the lungs are responsible for the defense of the body. And here we're talking tuberculosis, lungs, and we're talking about the defense mechanism. So there's a lot of similarity. And you'll see that typically in symptoms such as glands and night sweats and afternoon fevers and things like that. You know, it's not such a direct relationship in malaria. But I'll say with malaria that, you know, my friend Sigsbert, my partner in Africa, gets an extremely good rate of success with malaria. You know, he claims that he hardly ever fails with a malaria case. I mean, he knows it like the back of his hand. He can get up in the middle of the night and treat malaria. And, you know, he gets a great, great rate of results with that.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So, Jeremy, we're out of time. I want to just thank you again. It was a very informative, very interesting call. A lot of very useful information that was covered. I want to thank you. And can everyone else give a big thank you to Jeremy Scherer for joining us?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, everybody. Kim, I'd like to say one more thing.
Yes, please. Go ahead, Jeremy.
You know, Lois from Minnesota mentioned Eric, and I'd just like, to remember Eric here at this moment.
Can you just tell people who Eric Sommerman was?
Eric Sommerman, he was a very accomplished homeopath, and he founded the School of Homeopathy in Minnesota, and it's a very, very excellent, high-quality school. And unfortunately, he passed away last year, and that's a sad loss for all of us. You know, he did a great educational work, and he also did some wonderful provings. One of his provings that I'm using, you know, for instance, is sheep milk. It's a very useful remedy in many conditions, and I'd just like to pay tribute to him.
Thank you. That's very nice of you to do that. Thank you, Jeremy. All right, well, thank you, everyone, for joining us on the call today. Jeremy, special thanks to you, and we'll see you all soon.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.